why would Meta release something this powerful for free? Like, why would they make this available to everyone when Google's charging for it, OpenAI's charging for it? Like, we've talked about it on the show many times. Is open source good or bad? Does it create dangers to society? Welcome to the Artificial Intelligence Show, the podcast that helps your business grow smarter by making AI approachable and actionable. My name is Paul Raitzer. I'm the founder and CEO of Marketing AI Institute, and I'm your host. Each week, I'm joined by my co-host and Marketing AI Institute Chief Content Officer, Mike Kaput, as we break down all the AI news that matters and give you insights and perspectives that you can use to advance your company and your career. Join us as we accelerate AI literacy for all. Welcome to episode 93 of the Artificial Intelligence Show. I am your host, Paul Raitzer, along with my co-host, Mike Kaput. We are coming to you, this releases on April 23rd. We are recording 10:30 a.m. April 22nd. I don't know about you, Mike. I have not looked at Twitter yet this morning, so I don't know if anything has happened this morning that we needed to have, but it's crazy. Like, we... You know, again, I've shared how Mike and I do this, but basically, like, we sandbox articles, research reports, podcast episodes, videos all week long. And then Mike goes through on usually a Friday or maybe on a Sunday, curates everything into the topics. I'll then go through and make sure he and I are on the same page with what are main topics versus rapid fire, what's going to get moved to later. And I was sitting there having coffee this morning, like, prepping for this. And I messaged Mike. I was like, dude, I think we got to do two episodes this week. So I'm sort of like... getting this out ahead of time. There was literally no way to cover everything in this single episode this week that we were going to cover. And we honestly even like moved some things out. Spoiler alert, we're actually going to do a second episode this week because there's just so much to talk about. And I think so many important implications to the topics we're talking about. We have a lot to go through today, but we are going to do a second episode that should come out on Thursday, the 25th. So it's the same format. We're not, you know, it's not a different format. It's basically going to be three main topics and seven rapid fire items or so, because otherwise I didn't know how we were going to get through everything. So double up this week. We'll be with you on Tuesday and Thursday this week. And then everything else that happens, we'll do our usual episode next week. All right. So today's first episode of the week is brought to us by Rasa.io. is the ultimate game changer for AI-powered newsletters. Rasa.io's smart newsletter platform tailors your newsletter content for each and every subscriber and automates tedious newsletter production tasks. We've known the team at Rasa for years now. We literally have. I think they were one of the first companies we started talking to back in 2016-17 when the Institute was created. I think their solution is well worth checking out. Mike and I have used it for years for internal purposes. We don't use it to send our external newsletters, but Mike and I actually use it as a research tool internally to kind of keep up on information. So we've, you know, been testing it out ourselves for years now. So join 500-plus organizations leveraging Rasa.io. and get a personalized demo today at Rasa, that's R-A-S-A, .io/MAII. We also have a note today that our 2024 State of Marketing AI survey is now open and in the field. So we've been doing this. Is this the third year, Mike, or fourth year we're doing this
survey?
I think
it's third year.
Yeah. Third year. So last year we had over 900 respondents take this. It's about about 20 questions, Mike, 21 questions, something like that. So you can take it in probably like 4 or 5 minutes. It's pretty fast. We would really appreciate you taking the time to give us your responses. We're partnering with Drift again this year. They've been our partner on this every year. So we appreciate Drift and their support. But it takes a deep dive into how hundreds, hopefully this year, thousands of marketers are actually using and applying AI in their work. By filling out the survey, you're helping the entire industry grow smarter about AI. Only takes a few minutes, as I said. We will send you a copy of it when it releases, which Mike is slated for when? When are we dropping the results?
It's in late July.
Okay. So coming this summer. So the survey will be open now for another month or so?
Couple hopefully. Months, yeah. Okay. We'll probably do about 60 days or so, yeah.
Okay. But don't delay. Go take it now so you don't forget. So go to stateofmarketingai.com. Again, that's stateofmarketingai.com. You can, one, download last year's report while you're there, so you can see the report from last year. And there is a link to go and take this year's survey. So again, we appreciate you taking the time to take that and can't wait to share the results of that later this summer. And again, thanks to Drift, our partner on that research. Okay, Mike. Llama 3 was all the rage last week. Let's start there.
Yeah, let's just say it's been a big week for Meta because they announced the release of Llama 3, which is the next version of their foundational open source AI model. And Meta says that Llama 3 outperforms other open source models like Gemma from Google and Mistral. And it also appears on at least certain benchmarks to outperform Gemini Pro 1.5 and Claude 3 Sonnet. Now, today, there are two open source Llama 3 models that developers can freely use. There's an 8 billion parameter model and a 70 billion parameter one. There's also a 405 billion parameter version of Llama 3 that is coming soon and is still being trained. It's unclear right now, though, if the 405 billion version will be open source, but it is going to be in the wild at some point soon. Now, Meta actually told The Verge that Llama 3's training dataset is 7 times the size of Llama 2's. They also mentioned it did not use any Meta user data in its training. Notably, the training data does include a mix of what the company says is, quote, public internet data and synthetic AI generated data. Now, on top of all this, what's exciting is the fact that Llama 3 is now going to be powering the Meta AI assistant. And that assistant is now being integrated across Instagram, Facebook, WhatsApp, and Messenger. Meta AI as a tool has been kind of out for a while, but Llama 3 is going to give it a pretty serious upgrade in capabilities. And the wider rollout means you're going to be seeing a lot more of it across these core Meta apps. And if you want to go try it out for yourself outside of those platforms, you can go to meta.ai, and it looks kind of like a, you know, ChatGPT-like interface where you can interact with the Meta AI assistant. Now, it provides outputs just like ChatGPT. It's a general purpose assistant. You can ask questions, have it perform tasks for you that are, you know, research-based. It also allows you to generate images. And it's pretty noteworthy, Meta AI can actually search the web for you as you interact with it as well. So, Paul, first, I kind of want to put this into context for the audience. Like, we've been waiting for some time for Llama 3, and it seems like it's quite a big deal because it is this extremely powerful open source model. Like, how big a deal is this release?
It's a really big deal. So I've spent the last few days just trying to kind of like process this and help put it in context for everyone. So Mike, interject at any point, but I'm going to kind of go through some key points here that I think help everyone understand the significance of this. And as I've said before, history matters here. Like, the context of history here is very important to understanding what's going on. So first, a quick note. I think this may be what Meta used. If not, it's just ironic. But Hugging Face announced on April 21st, so that was Sunday, we have just released FineWeb, 15 trillion tokens of high-quality web data. We filtered and deduplicated all common crawl between 2013 and 2024. So I think Hugging Face has either made the training set that Meta used open or just ironically also a 15 trillion called FideWeb. So that's kind of a breakthrough that will enable the training of models moving forward. So Hugging Face made that announcement. Another quick note just on kind of beginner's guide to LLMs. A parameter refers to, so we talk about 8B and 70B. That's the billion parameters. So a parameter refers to a learned variable that the model uses to make predictions and generate, you know, outputs, generate text, images. Generally speaking, the number of parameters, the more parameters there are, that gets into the size, complexity, and capabilities of the model. So in general, more parameters means better capabilities, natural language tasks, knowledge retention, reasoning, all those things. So as the models get bigger, so we get to 405 billion. I don't think, at least in my research again this morning, like I don't think OpenAI has ever confirmed how many parameters were in GPT-4, but it's rumored to be anywhere from 500 billion to over a trillion. So we don't know. Gemini 1.5, again, I don't think they disclose the number of parameters, but it's also believed to be in that range. So that's kind of just basics. So now the big question is, why open source? Like, we've talked about it on the show many times. Is open source good or bad? Is it, does it create dangers to society? And so I think, like, to understand why would Meta release something this powerful for free? Like, why would they make this available to everyone when Google's charging for it, OpenAI's charging for it, Mistral is playing in the open source world, they're releasing free things? So to actually understand it, you have to go back to the formation of FAIR, which is the Facebook AI Research Lab. So this story is actually told in Genius Makers. So many times on this show, I've suggested people read Genius Makers by Cade Metz. So if you have read it, this will sound familiar to you, but I think this sets up, we'll go back to 2013 and then we're going to come back to today. And I think everyone will understand exactly what's happening here. So you have to go back to 2013 when Zuckerberg tried to buy DeepMind. So DeepMind, again, Demis Hassabis, Shane Legg, Mustafa Solomon, founders of DeepMind, 2010, they created a London-based research lab. That lab eventually sold to Google in 2014. Well, Facebook tried to buy them. They failed. So here's a couple of excerpts from Genius Makers that set the stage. So in 2013, it was a strange idea. The wider tech industry, including most engineers and executives at Facebook, hadn't even heard of deep learning and certainly didn't understand its importance. So deep learning is basically this idea of neural nets, which are, you know, decades old. But Jeff Hinton had sort of coined the term deep learning around 2008, 2009 to sort of give a modern twist on this idea of neural nets. But it was the idea that AI could have understanding, language, vision capabilities, give it a human-like abilities is what deep learning enabled. So 2013, again, only 11 years ago, Facebook and Zuckerberg weren't really paying that much attention to deep learning. It wasn't really a big thing yet. It did not do the kind of research, so Facebook it's referring to, again, back to Genius Makers, did not do the kind of research DeepMind aimed to do, which was more about exploring new frontiers than moving fast and breaking things. But now, after growing into one of the world's most powerful companies, Zuckerberg was intent on racing the others, Google, Microsoft, Apple, and Amazon, to the next big thing. This is how the industry works. The largest companies are locked in a never-ending race toward the next transformative technology, whatever that might be. Each is intent on getting there first, and if someone beats them to it, then they are under immense pressure to get there too without delay. Zuckerberg was intent on bringing deep learning research to Facebook. In the end, Zuckerberg and Schefter, the CTO, I think Schroeper, I don't know how to say his name, made an unsuccessful bid for DeepMind. Hassabis told colleagues that he felt no chemistry with Zuckerberg. Again, this is really, really important context. So Hassabis told colleagues that he felt no chemistry with Zuckerberg, that he didn't quite understand what the Facebook founder was trying to do with DeepMind, and that the lab wouldn't fit Facebook's growth-obsessed corporate culture. But the bigger issue for Hassabis, Legg, and Solomon was that Zuckerberg didn't share their ethical concerns over the rise of artificial intelligence in either the near term or the far. He refused, being Zuckerberg, to accept a contractual clause that guaranteed DeepMind's technology would be overseen by an independent ethics board. Quote, "We could have made more money if we had just been going for the money," Legg says, Shane Legg, the co-founder, "but we weren't." So it goes on to say, Facebook faced the chicken and egg problem. It couldn't attract top researchers because it didn't have a research lab. And it didn't have a research lab because it couldn't attract top researchers. So Zuckerberg, based on some guidance, set his sights on recruiting Jan LeCun to Facebook to run this lab. LeCun initially shut down these overtures. So there's a quote in here. It says, in a phone call with Zuckerberg, LeCun said, "I can consult with you, but that's about it. He had had similar conversations with Schrepp, which is, you know, the guy, short for the guy's name, in the past, and his stance had always been the same. Zuckerberg, though, kept pushing. Facebook was at another dead end. Schrepp had approached several other leaders in the field, from Andrew Ng, who we know is the founder of Coursera. He was the founding lead of Google Brain, and Yashia Bengio, who's an AI legend, research legend. And still, the company didn't have anyone to run its lab, someone with the heft needed to attract the world's top researchers. So again, still in 2013, he gets to a dinner with Jan LeCun. Just between the two of them, Zuckerberg explained his grand vision for AI at Facebook in the future, and this is really, really important. He told LeCun, interactions on the social network would be driven by technologies powerful enough to perform tasks on their own. Sounds a lot like AI agents, doesn't it? In the short term, these technologies would identify faces and photos, recognize spoken commands, and translate between languages. In the longer term, intelligent agents or bots would patrol Facebook's digital world, take instructions, and carry them out as need be. Need an airline reservation? Ask a bot. Order flowers for your wife? A bot could do that. When LeCun asked if there were any areas of AI research that would not interest Facebook, Zuckerberg said, probably robotics, but everything else, everything in the digital domain, was in bounds. Two other quick excerpts. The bigger issue was how Zuckerberg viewed the philosophy of corporate research. LeCun believed in openness, concepts, algorithms, and techniques openly shared with the wider community of researchers, not sequestered inside a single company or university. The idea was that this free exchange of information accelerated the progress of research as a whole. Everyone could build on the work of everyone else. Open research was the norm among academics in the field, but not in big internet companies. Facebook, Zuckerberg explained, was a big exception. They had built on open source. They believed deeply in it. And so basically, Zuckerberg and LeCun agreed to pursue this together. But LeCun's stipulations was he was not leaving New York. He was not leaving New York University. And basically, Facebook had to agree to keep everything open. Because in LeCun's opinion, that was how you were going to recruit the best researchers. So that's the context of why is Meta so committed to open source? One, that is what Zuckerberg committed to LeCun they would do, and LeCun still runs AI at Facebook. Two, it is the foundational belief. The thing that wasn't discussed, though, in Genius Makers and hasn't been probably as widely discussed is the more likely scenario, or a third key component of this, is the competitive element. Facebook has, according to their own earnings reports, most recent, so this is from 2024, they have 3.07 billion monthly active users on Facebook. So that doesn't even include WhatsApp and Instagram, I don't think. So that's just Facebook. So we've always talked about distribution being key. So everything that we're going to talk about with Llama 3 and what Facebook is doing is, at to this point, open source and free as a user. So there was a great tweet I saw from Naveen Rao, who's the VP of Gen AI Databricks, and he said, I don't think everyone has comprehended the massive disruption and distortion that is going to happen in the Gen AI market due to Llama 3. Moats will be destroyed and investments will go to zero. Just like everything in Gen AI, this will all happen fast. So now we kind of come to the Llama announcement. I don't know, Mike, if you have tried this yet, but have you gone to meta.ai yet?
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
It is. Okay. So meta.ai, for everybody, if you haven't tried it yet, go to it. You have to log into through your Facebook account. At least I had to. I couldn't do anything without it. So they released meta.ai with the Llama 3 announcement. The thing that, again, Mike and I mess with this stuff all day, every day. I was blown away by the autocomplete image generation thing. Mm. Did you try that yet?
I did. It was really, really cool. Yeah.
So if you haven't seen this yet, the way this works is, if you think about autocomplete, like in Gmail, where it's like finishing your sentences, or when you're in Google search and it's like finishing your search query, they are doing that for image generation. So if you start, like, I was just playing around with, like, my daughter's favorite thing is pandas, like her favorite animal. So I was like, imagine a panda. And so it creates a panda. And I was like, on the moon, and it's on the moon instantly. Drinking a glass of scotch, playing cards with his friend, and it's like, now he's got cards in front of him, and the friend is a red panda instantly. Like, it's just, and it's so fast. And so it's now creating the image as you're typing. It's auto-completing the image. It is wild. And I assume where they're going with this is like video audio completion eventually. And like, you can start to see the potential of this, but this is also baked right into Facebook, Instagram, and I assume WhatsApp. I don't use WhatsApp, but I have tested it in Facebook and Instagram. And so you have now your search bar in Facebook and Instagram is basically a Ask Meta AI, I think is what it says. I have seen people complaining, like, how do I get rid of this Meta AI thing? What is this thing? So, like we've always said, like, eventually this stuff trickles into society, and now we have billions of people with access to Meta AI, and, you know, your relatives and friends may be like, what in the world is this Meta AI thing? And you can now explain to them what it is. So that is like the real key is they're opening it. But by doing this, it is a direct attack on OpenAI, Google, Mistral, like Anthropic, everybody, because what Zuckerberg is basically saying is like, hey, we're going to spend whatever they're spending here, $100 billion, or eventually they'll spend $100 billion. They're probably spending a couple hundred million right now. Maybe the 405B model is going to be a half a billion to whatever $750 million training run. And they're just basically like, yeah, whatever. Like, we'll give it away for free because everybody else is trying to charge for it. So they can basically undercut everybody, and then they can make it, you know, readily available, not only build on top of, but to build right into their network. So that was, it was amazing how they did it, but to start seeing the technology and to seeing their play and to know that while they've been doing AI for 11 years, basically, you know, it's been a key part with the research lab, and, you know, machine learning longer than that. They've really been only playing this gen AI game since like late 2022. And here they are with Llama 3 that is, you know, apparently on par with at least GPT 3.5, if not, you know, probably GPT 4 once the 405B model comes out. So I had one other thought on the Dwarkesh podcast, but I don't know, any other thoughts from you, Mike, and just like what you're seeing so far and kind of early thoughts on Llama 3?
Yeah, I just think it's worth belaboring the competitive disruption point here. And I think you had surfaced, Paul, another tweet from a user basically was saying, look, by releasing this, Zuckerberg undermines competitors to the point of destruction. It's like if these companies were all teams in a strategy game, Zuckerberg just nuked part of the map, I feel like, in turn, and prevented the others from benefiting from it. So I think that's very fascinating. I think you have to maybe just consider the more cynical or self-interested or realpolitik motivations here if you're trying to understand where defensible moats are, where competitive advantage is going to lay moving forward.
Yeah, and you hear about these like wartime CEOs, like Zuckerberg's a killer. Like, whether you like the guy or not, there is no issues with him doing what has to be done to win. Like, that is what he has always done, where some of these other, you know, big tech companies we talk about maybe just don't have that mindset. So yeah, that matters. So the other thing I'll note is, I would suggest if you're really interested in this stuff, go listen to this podcast, but Dwarkesh Patel, who we've talked about before on the show, he had one of the two interviews Zuckerberg did. So the way they basically dropped Llama 3 was they put out a release about it on their own site. And then Zuckerberg did two podcast interviews and then they just put it on social. Like, that was the launch plan for this entire open source model. So a few key topics that Zuckerberg addressed in this interview with Dwarkesh. So one is 405B is in training now, like that is actively going, and it's already approaching GPT-4 level, and the training isn't even done yet. So he said, like, hey, this thing is going to be really, really powerful. We're already seeing incredible results on standard benchmark testing, and we're not even done training it yet. There was an interesting side note where he talked about, you know, we mentioned a few episodes ago how they were going to have the equivalent of like 650,000 GPUs from NVIDIA by the end of 2024, I think it was.
Yeah.
And so he asked him about that. And apparently they pre-bought a lot of these things in 2022 when they were building out the Reels capability because they were so far behind TikTok. And he said, ironically, some of the most important decisions we made were to catch up from previous screw-ups. So he said, like, we were behind, like TikTok killed us. So we had to come out with Reels. And so they envisioned a world where they were going to need to do way more compute with Reels. And so they bought double the amount of GPUs they had planned to just prepare for it, which then ended up having those GPUs there ready to be used for AI. So I just thought it was kind of interesting. Dwarkesh asked him about AGI and like, hey, when did that become kind of part of your focus? And he said it's basically been a progressive thing since they started the research lab 10 years ago. He said the idea was that along the way to general intelligence or whatever you want to call it, there are going to be all these different innovations and that's going to just improve everything we do. So we didn't conceive it of as a product. It was more research group over the last 10 years that was infused into their product. But then he went on to say like ChatGPT and the diffusion models really accelerated everything for them. They then saw the potential. When he got into asking him like, you know, what does he think about when he's building the next versions, Llama 4, Llama 5, Llama 6, whatever, there was a couple of things that I thought were interesting. One was he said, so much of the human brain is just dedicated to understanding people and understanding expressions and emotions. I think that's its own modality. You could say that maybe it's just video or image, but it's clearly a very specialized version of those two. So he talked a lot about emotions and expressions, which they obviously have a ton of data to build on, as being a key part of where they're going there. And then he talked about assistants and, you know, agents and things like that. And then they got into Llama 4, and he said, one of the trickiest things in the world to plan around an exponential curve. How long does it keep going? I think it's likely enough that we'll keep going. I think it's worth investing the tens of billions or hundreds of billions in building the infrastructure and assuming that if it keeps going, you're going to get some really amazing results. So again, we keep hearing this from Sam Altman for sure, Dario Amodei at Anthropic. I don't know about Jan LeCun. I don't know that he's always on board with this idea of the scaling laws, but now you're hearing it from Zuckerberg. They're basically saying like, yeah, we're going to invest hundreds of billions of dollars in energy and data centers and chips because to all of their knowledge, the scaling laws appear to be staying true, which means throw more compute, give it more data, give it more training time, and these models just get smarter. So that's why we're hearing Amazon building data centers next to nuclear power plants, why Altman's raising, you know, supposedly trillions of dollars for building out energy infrastructure. So it's all kind of connected. And then the last one I wanted to address here is, you know, again, Mike, you and I talk about, is open source good or bad for society all the time? And I'm always kind of shocked at how poorly they all are prepared to answer this question. So Dwarkesh, to his credit, pushed Zuckerberg on the topic of the dangers of open source as you start getting into these smarter models. And he basically said, they don't have a toxic, he said, Dwarkesh said, when would you not open source something? Like, what would you need to see in a future model that would stop you from open sourcing it due to concerns? And he said, they don't have a taxonomy for that yet, that they do in fact have 18 or 19 categories that they look at for harmful things related to social media that they plan for. And he said, basically, we probably need to do the same thing for this. But then he very quickly sort of just deflected the whole conversation and said, yeah, but centralizing AI could be worse. And this is the answer you get from all of them, whether it's Ahmad, formerly at Stability, or him, or Dario Amodei. It's like, yeah, it could get really, really bad, but we think it's better than like three key companies deciding our future. So I don't know about you, but like, it just doesn't sit well with me. Like I don't feel, and we'll talk about the Dario Amodei thing in the next episode, because I have a lot of, he just gave a pretty far reaching interview as well. And he had a lot of opinions on this that I have thoughts on, but I will just say Dario's thoughts echo what Zuckerberg's saying, which is like, yeah, it could go really, really bad, but as long as it's not centralized to like three companies that we don't trust, then it's better than the alternative. So it's, again, go listen to the interview. I don't know. Do you have any other thoughts on this one, Mike? It's,
no,
I feel like we could talk Llama 3 all day.
Oh my gosh. I know, we could do a whole episode on it. No, I think your concerns are well-founded with open source. I would suspect we're going to see some type of backlash once some truly damaging application comes out. I mean, I'm sure in the dark corners of the internet, it's already being misused, but there will be probably, my guess would be, some high profile examples where it's like, wait, somebody just downloaded this thing from GitHub or wherever and started doing whatever that it is that they've done. So I would fully expect, yeah, like we've talked about, that wider societal potential backlash against AI in general. I could see this being a component of that.
Yeah, and again, like I'm not for or against open source. Like I'm not even taking a stand that I think it's bad for society. It is truly one of these like unanswered things that every time I hear one of these massive advocates for open source talking, I keep waiting to hear the justification that I'm like, yeah, okay, actually I'm in the open source camp. No, I totally get what they're coming from. I understand their concerns around limiting AI to a few companies. We talked about that when Altman got fired and we're like, oh, we're trusting this company, this like dumpster fire of a company at that moment to shepherd an AGI. Like, okay, I kind of understand the need to have this open. So I'm very much in the middle here and just kind of like open-minded to any conversation, but I don't ever hear a good answer with the, yeah, but you're open sourcing a really powerful thing that can be used for disinformation and can be used for persuasion. And we can't assume everyone's going to be a good actor in this. They just kind of blow it off and say it's better than letting it be controlled by the government or these other entities. So be continued, I suppose.
Which tells me that it's inevitable we're going to get that future where it's just going to be allowed to proliferate however you want it to.
So I think we're probably there. We're going to be there this year.
Yeah. All right. So next up, Microsoft just released some research that details an AI model they created that can deepfake somebody using a single photo. So this model is called VASA-1, V-A-S-A-1, and it can use a photo to create a realistic video of a person talking or singing that you can sync up with an existing audio track. So Ars Technica had this description of the model. It says the VASA framework, short for Visual Affective Skills Animator, uses machine learning to analyze a static image along with a speech audio clip. It is then able to generate a realistic video with precise facial expressions, head movements, and lip syncing to the audio. Right now, this model, which is only in research mode at the moment, does not clone or simulate voices, though obviously there's plenty of tools that do that. Interestingly, this model, they say right in the reporting, was trained on YouTube clips because it used a data set created years ago by researchers that has a bunch of data extracted from videos uploaded to YouTube. So given the model's speed and power, this could actually potentially be used in real-time applications like video conferencing, or it could power avatars that just render locally on your machine. Now, Microsoft's researchers, wary of the ways this technology could be misused, say they are not openly releasing the code that powers the model at this time. So, Paul, while Microsoft isn't really releasing the code here, they're not the only AI lab working on this type of thing. We wanted to talk about it just because it is such a stark example of how quickly this technology has progressed. But I guess my question is, don't we just have to accept now that anyone can be deepfaked from a single image, whether or not Microsoft releases this particular version of this technology?
It's a recurring topic or theme on this podcast of like, we're just in a different place and most of society is blissfully unaware that this stuff happens. So when I saw this, I went back to our book, Mike, Marketing Artificial Intelligence. And so we released that in summer 2022, and I'll just read a quick excerpt from it. So we were in a chapter, we were talking about vision, AI vision technology and its implications. There was a section there called The Danger of Deepfakes to Your Brand. And we wrote, vision can also be applied to produce deepfake videos in which a person in an existing image or video is replaced with someone else's likeness. Prevalence and impact of deepfake videos is just beginning, and having an understanding of the underlying technology will help you prepare your brand for its potential. Now, in this case, we're talking about an image of a person that you just turn into a video. Went on to say, and this was me talking, I did a fair amount of crisis communications planning early in my career. Basically, you envision different scenarios of what could go wrong, then put strategies in place for how organizations will react. Then you hope none of it actually happens. Never did I imagine a day in which brands would be planning for deepfake videos of executives doing and saying things that never happen in real life, but here we are. But the interesting part is, we then went on to say, AI has made it possible and relatively easy with the right resources to create fake videos of people that appear and sound real. According to the Department of Defense, one of their people who is developing software to detect and prevent the spread of deepfakes, this was a quote. It only takes about 500 images or 10 seconds of video to create a realistic deepfake. And so that was 2022. You needed 500 images or 10 seconds of video. Here we are with a single image and a single audio clip, and we have deepfake technology. So in a two-year span, we have gone from the state of the art, which the Department of Defense probably had the most powerful stuff at the time, to this. So yeah, it's this recurring theme of, oh yeah, breakthrough happened. Sora from OpenAI is an example. We can now create minute-long videos that maintain their consistency, or we can generate videos from a single image, whatever it is. And this, we're not releasing it because, well, going back to the open source conversation, if they're doing it, then it's either already in other labs or it will be within 3 to 6 months. And there's going to be plenty of open source models who have no problem releasing it because they believe you release everything and you put it in the hands and democratize it, no matter how potentially dangerous it is. So if we hear about this tech from Microsoft or from OpenAI or whomever, assume that within 6 months, it will be open sourced by someone and this stuff will be all over the web.
And I think it's also worth noting here, there's just this inherent tension between the people creating the technology, but also trying to release it responsibly. Not at all knocking Microsoft. I'm glad they're thinking about how it could be misused. But like we've discussed, you get into this cycle or this game, this arms race, where it's like, even if they say they're not releasing it today, all we need is for someone else to make a breakthrough or to open source it or to OpenAI says, guess what? There's Sora free plans for everybody or whatever. Pick your category of AI. And suddenly Microsoft's like, oh, yeah, we can't not commercialize this anymore.
Yeah, so, you're right. It just takes one person to put it out in the world. And it's like, oh, okay, well, somebody else did it. Now we can go. It's what happened with ChatGPT.
Yes.
Google had the technology. They weren't willing to put that kind of technology out into the world. OpenAI had less to lose, so they did it. And then everybody else had to follow suit. So yeah, it's like, ah, man, it's going to get so weird.
Yeah. Yeah. This is probably another area where I know we've seen some pretty crazy deepfakes, but I feel like we've got at least a couple apocalyptic examples that are going to happen soon that people are going to be like, wait a sec, what? Yeah. You can do what?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So our third big topic today is pretty interesting commentary around a possible AI-powered paradigm shift that some people are starting to see in the SaaS space, software as a service space. And this is getting a fair amount of attention online, so we wanted to kind of unpack it. This concept is called service as software, and it's outlined in an essay from Foundation Capital, which is a VC firm that's invested in some notable companies like Netflix and some AI firms like Jasper. Now, Foundational Capital defines this idea of service as software as this paradigm shift that basically entails the fact that AI is causing a transition from software as a service to service as software. And what this means is, you know, in the past, you bought access to a software tool or a platform. This is how SaaS works today, how it worked before. You use this software to achieve your desired outcomes in your work. However, they argue that AI is changing this because it's not just giving you access to tools that make you more productive. It is giving you access to bots that essentially act as brains. In other words, when you buy an AI tool, you're buying access to technology that can increasingly perform some of the work, the tasks, the services for you instead of giving you the ability to do the service better, faster, cheaper on your own. So, like, as an example, instead of buying QuickBooks in order to make your finance team or an outside firm better at maintaining your books, you may in the future simply be buying access to an AI accountant that does the job of that finance professional or does the job of the outside firm. And this is a change that just has massive implications for both jobs and SaaS companies, according to Foundation Capital. So if you think of something like the basic value proposition of software like Salesforce, a human rep enters the data, Salesforce helps them do their job much more productively. But suddenly with AI, and especially with AI agents, you unlock capabilities and autonomous actions that far more resemble a skilled human performing a service, not just some piece of software that a person uses. So the whole point here, they argue, is that the size of the opportunity for AI disruption of services, of jobs, of roles, of tasks is far bigger than the opportunity that exists to disrupt existing SaaS tools. And so they ask, how much work will AI plus automation and the service as software model do away with? We believe this is a $4.6 trillion question. This is a number they get to by looking at salaries of jobs globally and the amount spent on outsourced services and salaries. So, Paul, there's a lot to unpack behind this concept, but I kind of wanted to just start by talking about this thesis seems directionally correct to me based on kind of what we know and teach. Like in my mind, we have to acknowledge we're no longer just building static tools that make employees more productive. That's part of what's being built in the world of AI. But we're also building technology that fundamentally alters how work is done and determines which work gets done by a human. Does that map at all to kind of how you're thinking about this?
Yeah, and I think it's a really delicate dance for these software companies. So I had to laugh. Like the first time I saw this service as software quote, I was like, is that meaning the software companies building AI are having to sell services because they're not making enough money? That was what I assumed it
was. I thought that too, yeah.
And then I saw like Brian Halligan tweeted it and I was like, well, Halligan wouldn't be tweeting that if that's what that meant. And so I like started digging in a little bit more. So I think like the delicate dance I'm referring to is, again, if you listen to the show regularly, you've heard me say like my agency PR 2020 that I sold in 2020 was HubSpot's first partner back in 2007. So we built our entire agency around being a value added reseller and partner of HubSpot's. And so HubSpot customers that didn't want to do the work would come to my firm and we would build plans, we would create content. That's where Mike and I worked together at PR 2020. And so that was what we did. We added value to HubSpot software by providing services to their customers who did not have the internal capabilities to do these things. And so now we're entering into this phase where whether it's QuickBooks or Salesforce or HubSpot or take your pick of SaaS tool, the SaaS companies themselves can be thinking of their software as part of the org chart, in essence, as outside providers. They're not just selling the software, the tools to do the job. They're selling you an agent that can do the job, so you don't need an outside agency in potentially. So this certainly aligns with what we talked about last week on episode 92 with Google positioning their AI agents as customer agents, employee agents, creative agents, data agents, code agents, security agents. They're positioning these AI tools that can do things, that can take actions, in essence, as people. They're able to do a bundle of tasks, which a job is basically just a bundle of tasks. I found myself this weekend revisiting the GPTs, our GPTs paper from OpenAI, which they released when GPT-4 came out in 2023. And that's the basic premise, is that these things are general purpose technologies that are capable of evolving, they're capable of being built on top of, and they're able to do things that humans would do. So I think this is the thing that people just aren't talking enough about, that as we follow these scaling laws that we touched on earlier, that Zuckerberg believes in and Altman believes in and Anthropic believes in, like they all are believing in these scaling laws. And if these laws hold, we will, in the not too distant future, have relatively reliable agents that can function doing many of the tasks that would make up a job. And again, I've said this before, like I just don't hear from large enterprises who are addressing this, who are actually thinking about what this means and preparing for it. And for agencies, like we talked a couple episodes ago about how much Accenture's making, like $640 million or whatever in a quarter, just doing AI consulting work. you do have to look out to the future and say, well, that could keep scaling. They could be a 10, you know, billion or whatever. Or 2 years from now, the agents are just going to do most of the stuff that they're making consulting money on. I don't know. Like, I don't know where it goes, but this is definitely, as you said, kind of directionally what we're seeing is it's going to be very narrow to start. You're not going to have this general agent that I just go and get one agent from HubSpot or Salesforce or Adobe or whatever, and it just does the job of all of my people. But you're going to have these tasks, and maybe they're like think of it as like AI roles, like customer service, BDR, marketer, podcast producer, social media manager, whatever it is, that you're training these agents to be very specifically fine-tuned to do a bundle of 10 or 15 or 20 tasks. And now all of a sudden, it becomes very disruptive to jobs. Right now, we have distinct tasks that are able to be automated. In the not too distant future, we will have bundles of tasks, and that's what a job is.
Yeah. I think also what jumped out at me is in this post from Foundation Capital, they're kind of trying to quantify, right, with this $4.6 trillion question. They're trying to quantify what is the size of the opportunity in terms of salaries being paid for different roles. And we talk about quite often, we've talked about since way back when we started reading the quants, it's like, what is the opportunity to disrupt things? I think the equation is something to the effect of the technology being able to do it plus the size of the opportunity. So when I look at a chart like this, I see a ton of very hungry AI startups that are going to start coming for salaried work, perhaps. I mean, I don't think it'll be that, like you said, all at once, but the incentives here give me some pause to think about.
Yeah. And I think like the Quants was one book that you and I both read in the early days. And the other one that, you know, really started my path down AI was Automate This by Christopher Steiner.
Yes.
And I think that's where we originally saw that quote was like the potential to disrupt plus the reward for disruption. And that was actually the quote that led me to say, well, hold on a second. This is 2012. AI is going to come for marketing and sales and service. It's not here yet, but like the potential to disrupt is massive. And what you're saying is the potential to disrupt the service industry is way greater than even the software industry. And so it would make a ton of sense that that's where these research labs and tech companies would be focusing on. Is like, hey, if we can, coding's great. Like writing code is really helpful. But if we can actually augment or replace work, now they're not going to call it that. No one is going to say our job is to replace workers. Like it's not going to be anybody's tagline, but that is what they are all thinking. Like I cannot tell you how many times a month I hear this when I'm meeting with companies or talking to people at companies. The thing no one's saying, but the thing we're being directed to is, do we need as many humans in the future? It's not going to be in earnings calls. Like, they're not going to talk about this, but it is the thing they are all talking about, if that makes sense.
Yep. That's exactly what I'm getting at. I think that's wise for people to keep in mind as we move forward and see what happens here. All right, let's jump into some rapid fire topics. So we got some huge news this week related to AI for video editing. So Adobe just announced that they plan to add AI video generators, including Sora, Runway, and Pika to Premiere Pro, which is one of the world's most popular video editing programs. So in the announcement, Adobe said that OpenAI Sora, Runway ML's Gen 2, and Pika 1.0 would be made available via plugins to Premiere Pro users. Now, right now, there's no timetable for when this becomes available, and it's still a bit unclear how this would work exactly, given that some of the tools require paid subscriptions. Sora is not even publicly available yet, so we have to kind of see on that. However, the news has the video community pretty excited, especially given how popular Adobe products are. I mean, there's 33 million paying Creative Cloud customers right now. So I thought one point jumped out at me from an AI creator named Bilawal Sidhu, who shared one reason that he's really excited about it. He said, this is, quote, amazing for creatives, because to do anything compelling with AI video generation models, you need to bring them into a video editing tool. So, Paul, that stuck with me because it seems like AI adoption has the potential to skyrocket the moment some of these powerful tools and capabilities get baked right into the stuff like Adobe that people are using every day to do their existing work. So what were your thoughts on hearing this announcement?
One, I would say go watch the video. It was pretty impressive. Like, it's about like a minute and a half of how they're envisioning this working, where you're already working in Adobe Pro and you click a thing and you drop down, you want to extend a scene or you want to edit a scene, and you just pick the model you're going to use. So my first reaction was, it seems like it functions very similar to Perplexity, where I can pick what model I want to work with, how AWS, I think, is envisioning what they're doing, how Google, like, they're all kind of making it where, yeah, we have our own models, like Adobe, we got our model, but if you're a Sora user or you want to have capabilities of Pika, like, whatever, like, it's all, you know, it's kind of built right in. So my first thought was, for these tools, great distribution. I don't know how many Adobe users there are. I tried to look it up. I couldn't find a firm number on how many Adobe Premiere users there are, but I would guess it's hundreds of thousands, if not in the millions. So it's a quick way for Adobe to level up. So for these tools, great distribution. You know, they get their tools in front of a bunch of people. For Adobe, quick way to level up and offer these capabilities so people maybe stay within their platform makes a lot of sense. Definitely seems to run counter to Adobe's current or previous position on the licensing of training data. If they're basically saying, hey, yeah, we're being pretty selective about our training data, but hey, everybody else, just come on in. We don't really care how you trained your models. So it seems like we're just gradually moving to the point where these companies are all just like, yeah, we don't care. Like, we're just going to keep using this training data until somebody tells you it's illegal. And they're just going to gradually, you'll just all of a sudden, these positions they took previously on the legitimacy of training data are just going to disappear from their sites. It just seems very obvious that's where this is going. Seems really disruptive. Like, if we go back to the previous conversation around AI agents, again, the marketing and positioning is all, you know, sunshine and rainbows. Like, this is great and creatives love it. The other alternative, though, is like, people's jobs like are involved with doing this. Like, if you're able to all of a sudden generate B-roll without having to hire a film crew and actors, and like, people make money doing what they're now going to automate with a drop-down model. I'm not, again, not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying we should talk about the fact that this isn't all good. Like, every announcement is always like, it's just great and people love it.
Right.
No, the people you're featuring in your news release love it. There's a whole bunch of people who don't. And I'm not saying we should slow anything down or it shouldn't happen. I'm just saying we should be more transparent about the negative impacts that this is going to have on people.
To your point, in this segment and also the previous one, I do read, and I've read this phrase multiple times for certain video editing tools. Anytime someone's saying, you can do all this great stuff without filming additional footage, that feels like code to me.
It is definitely code. You know,
I don't know enough about video editing and production. Obviously, there's going to be new opportunities created, but yeah, that reads like code to me, like we're trying to say something else here.
Yeah, and all those extras in Hollywood that you got to sign off on their digital likeness, recreate them in the scene. Like, you don't need to go bring in the extras, just, you know, take 50 extras from previous movies that you have owned the digital likeness for and just generate them using this tool. And the stuff that isn't being said, again, and I think that's hopefully what one of the things people take away from this podcast all the time is, there is a whole separate thing happening here that isn't talked about. And I think it's really important that people understand that and that we start talking about it, because it's the only way for us to be ready for the change that's happening.
Yeah, for sure. I'm giggling here, but like, I take it very seriously. I think we just need to have the discussion, because you have to go in with your eyes as wide open as possible to the disruption that's coming. All right. So next up, robotics company Boston Dynamics is turning heads with a new robot. They announced that they're transitioning to a fully electric version of their Atlas robot, which is a humanoid robot designed to perform tasks and labor in the real world. As part of this announcement, the company released this about 40-second video that shows the all-electric Atlas go from lying on the ground to rising to its feet and walking around with surprising agility. Boston Dynamics says they're partnering with a small group of customers to test and iterate applications for Atlas over the next few years. And the first customer they're doing this with is Hyundai, the car maker. On this partnership, the company said, quote, in the months and years ahead, we're excited to show what the world's most dynamic humanoid robot can really do in the lab, in the factory, and in our lives. I thought it was also interesting they gave a nod to how quickly the field of robotics is moving, which we discussed at length, Paul, when you outlined your timeline of AI innovation in episode 87. Boston Dynamics said, quote, "A decade ago, we were one of the only companies putting real R&D effort into humanoid robots. Now the landscape in the robotics industry is very different." Paul, what did you think of the Atlas announcement? How does this kind of play into what you see as the timeline for robotics?
Definitely is on track. I wouldn't update my timeline currently. I think we are continually moving, if anything, over time. I think some of the things I said in that timeline will just shorten, but I think this shows we're aggressively heading in a direction where humanoid robots are going to be key. Second thing is, watch the video. It's creepy as hell, man.
It's so weird.
If you haven't seen it, it's like laying flat, all folded up, and then the head pops up and turns, and then the body contort. It's really creepy. It's like very sci-fi like. Third thing is, I wonder if Google is going to regret selling Boston Dynamics. So for people who don't know, Google owned Boston Dynamics. They sold them to SoftBank in 2017. So 2017, when the year the Transformer was invented, we didn't have the breakthroughs in intelligence we're seeing now that we talked about a few episodes ago, how like Figure and OpenAI are now working to embody language models in the robot. Well, Google had the leading robots at the time, and in theory, they could be now dropping Gemini into robotics. But here we are, you know, however many years later, and looks like Hyundai actually owns Boston Dynamics now, which I did not know. They completed the acquisition in June of 2021 from SoftBank. So yeah, I know Google could have been a major player, but at the time we just had, you know, robot dogs racing around and robots doing flips on things. And now we have embodied intelligence and robots.
All right. So next up, the popular AI avatar generator, a tool called HeyGen, just released a demo of an incredible new feature that allows you to create user-generated content, UGC, using an AI spokesperson. So all you need is a URL of a product page on Amazon, Shopify, etc. And HeyGen will use it to create for you a video of a hyper-realistic AI avatar promoting your product or service. Now, as part of this process, HeyGen will generate a script based on details that you input and then allow you to select which avatar you want to use and what format you want your video in. So within a couple minutes, you can literally generate a full video with an AI avatar that is reading your script. Now, Paul, this is obviously a beta product. HeyGen's releasing it as a demo right now. It has bugs. It's not perfect. But I was pretty impressed with just how good some of this looks. Like, should we be expecting an influx of AI-generated promotional content online, like AI influencers and ad spokesmen?
Yeah, I feel like this kind of technology, one, it's not only HeyGen's going to have it. Everybody's going to have this. I feel like by this time in 2025, this stuff's just going to be everywhere. You could definitely see early adoption in like the SaaS industry. Like the early adopting industries are going to be using this stuff like crazy. I don't think your average bank or hospital or manufacturing company is necessarily going to be powering their sales and marketing with this stuff, but you could see this take off in kind of those early adopters. And I think it could become pretty prevalent, which I'm not necessarily a fan of. I'm a bystander commenting on it. It doesn't matter if I like it or not. I feel like this is the kind of technology that will just snowball at some point.
All right. We also got a new interview with Sam Altman that just dropped, courtesy of the popular podcast 20VC. In it, VC and host Harry Stebbings interviews Altman and OpenAI COO Brad Lightcap about a range of topics, from OpenAI's operational challenges and opportunities to how to invest and operate in a world where OpenAI appears to be dominating parts of the AI arms race. So, Paul, we both listened to this. You had a couple things jumped out to you, it sounds like, about the interview.
Yeah, unlike the Zuckerberg interview, I wouldn't say there was as many like noteworthy things. It was just kind of a lot of like back and forth, but some interesting stuff. But the one quote that I will say, it doesn't have quite the shock value of the episode 86 and 87 Altman quote that we talked about, but I will read this excerpt anyway. So when being asked about GPT-5 and, you know, what kind of companies could exist, what kind of moats exist, he said, and I quote, "Here are two strategies there are two strategies to build on AI right now. There's one strategy, which is to assume the model is not going to get better. And then you kind of like build all these little things on top of it. So basically what we would call like wrappers. Then there's another strategy, which is to build assuming that OpenAI is going to stay at the same rate of trajectory and the models are going to keep getting better at the same pace. It would seem to me that 95% of the world should be betting on the latter category, but a lot of startups have been built in the former category. When we just do our fundamental job because we have a mission, we're going to steamroll you. GPT-5 will be on par with the leap from 3 to 4. So again, all indications have been and continue to be that GPT-5 is going to be a massive leap forward that is really hard to project right now and to comprehend. But Sam talks with an awful lot of confidence of someone who has probably seen what is likely going to be possible. And I feel like he is increasingly being vocal to prepare people for the amount of disruption that is coming. Again, Sam's history isn't to say things until he's ready and confident about what he has to say. And he is being increasingly direct about the need for people to comprehend how much change is coming.
All right. This next one's not nearly as weighty or impactful, but it's near and dear to our hearts, Paul. A new song has just been released by Drake that's getting attention for its use of AI. And that's because the song features full AI-generated verses from both Snoop Dogg and Tupac. So on this track, you're literally hearing highly realistic voice clones of both artists rapping, and then Drake himself wraps up the song with a verse. Now, I don't really know if I have too much to say other than this was just wild to me to hear as a fan of these artists. I mean, what was your reaction when you heard this?
Yeah, well, I think I spent more time trying to understand why the diss track was being released.
Yes, there's
a
lot of content.
What Rick Ross had to do with any of this. And like, I was watching literal like videos, like dissecting how all the people had all these beef with different people. My first reaction was, is that illegal? Literally my first reaction was, does Snoop Dogg like know this happened? And I'd actually went to Snoop Dogg's Twitter account and he posted a video at like 2 a.m. that was just kind of playing it off as though maybe he knew this was happening. Tupac obviously can't release a video saying if he knew it was happening. So yeah, I don't know, but I did see a lot of tweets like, did we just open the floodgate? Like, has Drake basically just ushered in the era where you just do whatever you want with AI and it's just the accepted norm? And I feel like that also is kind of very near where people just do whatever they want with the AI and apologize later, basically.
Yeah, we talk a lot about how the AI arms race between big tech companies is pushing the envelope. And I don't think we spend enough time thinking about how beef between rappers might just like throw the rules out the window, you know?
And the relevance of Taylor Swift to it all, because apparently it had something to do with her dropping her album. So he waited a day to drop it. I don't know. Like I had to like dive into pop culture and hip hop culture for a couple of days last week to figure out what in the world was going on with everybody.
All right, couple final topics here. A company called Micro One has just released what it's calling, quote, the first ever AI interviewer. It's called GPT Vetting, and it's an AI tool that automatically interviews candidates for software engineering roles. So what you do is you tell the tool what skills you want the interview to focus on, and it automatically asks candidates verbal questions and conducts coding exercises with them. The entire process, it sounds like, takes about 20 to 30 minutes. You then review a report with an AI assessment of the person's skills, a trust score about how valuable they think the employee would be. And the company claims that in beta, this tool has already conducted 13,000 AI interviews, saving 10,000 hours that would otherwise be spent conducting technical interviews. Now, the publicly available examples of this are all focused, from what I could find, on software engineering for hiring coders, but the company's website also claims the tool can or will be able to be used for other interviews, like for project managers, designers, salespeople, and more. So, Paul, like any of the tools we talk about, we have to emphasize this is still really early. We're going off just public claims made by the company, so take everything with a grain of salt. However, if this works as advertised or could sometime soon, it seems to indicate the world of HR is about to change. What do you think?
Yeah, not just HR. I mean, ops, finance, sales, service, everything. So, you know, it's funny. You brought up the quote. I go back to it. The opportunity to disrupt plus the reward for disruption. The automate this premise. The way to think about this is there are only so many people in the world capable of building AI tools right now. Now that's being democratized. So like you and I can build our own AI tools a year or two from now when we have an idea. But for right now, there's only so many people capable of building it. So you look across industries and you say, which industry is most ripe for disruption from generative AI technology? And then you prioritize those and you go after them. Or you're a domain expert in HR and you say, I got to go find somebody to build a better way to do this. And you go find somebody willing to do it. But those people have lots of options of what to be building right now, where they can make the most money. So I feel like this is one of them. This is a very viable thing. I am, again, not commenting on whether I think this is actually a good idea or not. It seems very viable. But I will say again, the allure to do these things is going to be immense. When you have people who understand what these things are capable of doing, and they look at a challenge like how many hours, how many hundreds of thousands of hours are spent interviewing people every year, and they say, well, hold on a second. There's nothing they're doing that the AI can't do. And maybe even better, when you figure out that they can read emotions for videos, they can analyze people's writings, they can make predictions about the behaviors based on their writings. Like, you start to realize that AI is actually quite human level or beyond at a lot of the things that we do. And it just takes one person or one company to build that thing and then make it available to a lot of other people, and disruption all of a sudden just happens. So yeah, this one makes a ton of sense. I looked at it a little bit, seems like a viable use case.
Yeah.
Not saying it's good or bad, but it is. And I think that's more and more the reality of, like, oftentimes what we're commenting on here is, listen, this is just the reality. Like it or don't like it, you just got to figure out how to live with it and what to do about it, because we can't stop this sort of stuff from coming. Again, whether or not it should be used in some of these instances is up for debate.
This actually segues perfectly into kind of our final topic here, because Paul, you had wrote this week about a concept that we're kind of starting to see more of in business and marketing, and it's AI fatigue. And you wrote, I've been hearing a lot lately about business and marketing leaders who have AI fatigue. They're overwhelmed by existing responsibilities and goals and see AI as one more thing they have to worry about and learn, which may lead many to delegate AI understanding and adoption in their companies. I think this is the wrong approach. Could you walk us through what you mean here?
Yeah. So the analogy that I used in there is, like, if we go back to 1994 and the internet is, you know, getting ready to really burst onto the scene and change the future of society and business and communications and relationships and everything, like truly just transformed everything. There are a lot of people in this world who feel like AI will be 10 to 100 times as transformative as the internet when all said and done over the next 5 to 10 years. If that is true, or even remotely close to true, let's just say it's on par with the internet for argument's sake. If you're a CEO, CMO, VP, director, like whatever, if you're a leader in a company, should you really be letting other people figure this out and you just stand on the sidelines and read the reports about what to do with it? My argument would be absolutely not. Like, this defines the future of your career, defines the future of your company, your industry. And so the point I was making is, like, hey, listen, I get it. Like, this is hard. There is a lot to process here. It can be overwhelming when we all have full-time jobs. But the only option to me moving forward is you have to figure out a way to stay on this. If it's just listening to this podcast every week, great. Like, hopefully that is what we're helping do for a lot of you, is give you that 1 hour a week where you can really think about this stuff. But my point was, you have to make time to learn. If it is podcasts, books, online courses, attending events, subscribing to newsletters, or just having a small group of trusted people that can vet this stuff for you and tell you what it means. And then the second thing was, like, you have to experiment with it. Like I said earlier, like, go, your assignment for this week, go to meta.ai, connect your Facebook account, play around with the image generation tool, like experiment with it, see what's possible, because every company is going to need AI savvy practitioners and leaders. And the opportunities are going to be so immense for the people that, again, just fight through this period where it just seems overwhelming and too much, and there's too many other priorities going on. This has to be one of those priorities. Like, it can't be a topic you just push away for months at a time. Too much change will happen in a short amount of time to just stand by.
Amen. All right, that's a wrap this week. As a reminder,
today we'll be back
today.
This week.
Sorry, that's as a reminder. Yeah, this week you're gonna get another episode, episode 94 on Thursday, April 25th. So twice as nice this week with the artificial intelligence show. I would also encourage you, if you're getting value out of the podcast, it would help us immensely if you would go ahead and leave us a review on your podcast platform of choice. That helps us get the show into the hands of more people. I would also remind you, like we talked about at the top of the show, we have the State of Marketing AI survey out in the field for 2024. Your input on this survey, which takes just a few minutes to fill out, really helps us understand better AI adoption in marketing and helps everyone in the industry grow together. So go to stateofmarketingai.com to take that survey. And last but not least, tune into the Marketing AI Institute's newsletter, which goes out every week and summarizes all the news you need to know, including stuff we don't cover or can't get to on each episode of the podcast. Go to marketingaiinstitute.com/newsletter. Paul, thanks so much, and get ready to run it back.
Yeah, thanks everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again in a couple of days. Thanks for listening to The AI Show. Visit marketingaiinstitute.com to continue your AI learning journey and join more than 60,000 professionals and business leaders who have subscribed to the weekly newsletter, downloaded the AI blueprints, attended virtual and in-person events, taken our online AI courses, and engaged in the Slack community. Until next time, stay curious and explore AI.